So, we come to chapter 23 of Essays on the Gita. And if we see the whole book, so 24 chapters and 24 chapters, total 48. But the first 24 chapters, Sri Aurobindo dedicates primarily to the first 6 chapters of the Gita. And there is a reason for it. If you read through his Bangla writing, which are also wonderful with regard to introduction to the Gita, the kernel of the most of the important aspects of the Gita's teaching, the take-home points, the practice, is there in the first 6 chapters. Then the rest is a development over it. So, of course, they are important, but first 6 chapters from the point of view of practice. So, Sri Aurobindo has gone at great length. And also when we see the kind of conceptions and over a period of time, interpretations of the Gita, all that had developed from Sri Krishna's time till Sri Aurobindo. So, ultimately Gita, of course, has always been regarded as a great scripture. But the general understanding has been that karma is one of the means that the Gita gives for realizing the divine, which is all right. But having realized the divine, then it's no more necessary. This is the general understanding. So, before the Gita, what was the general consensus? If we read the Upanishads. So it's primarily jnana. So the method is jnana. If you read, go before Sri Krishna, primarily. There is some bhakti, there is some hint of other things. So jnana is the primary thing. And if you have to realize the divine through jnana, you don't really require to engage in works except the bare minimum. Then there came things like ritualistic interpretation, and you have to engage in ritualistic works. All this we have already discussed. But the Gita says, no, not only through the mind or jnana, but also works and bhakti. This is something very unique about the Gita. So all those who just mechanically keep saying that Gita is the, you know, Upanishad is the cow and the Gita takes the milk, it's not really true. There are things in the Gita which are not in the Upanishads. Sri Krishna is not repeating the Upanishads. Just as Sri Aurobindo is not repeating the Vedanta. There is something uniquely new. So in the Gita, first time we see that not only through jnana, but works and bhakti. So, okay, people would accept, some people accept that, okay, it's a synthesis of all the three. But the general interpretation is still the end point is union of the soul with the Purushottama. So just the quick difference is that Upanishadic age, I'm not saying it's not there, but it's in the background. Primarily, union is with the Brahman, the immutable divine, if you want to put it. But they don't use the word, they use the word Brahman. A very impersonal sort of state, and you unite with that. But the Gita brings in the idea of Purushottam, and this is very important, because if immutable Brahman is the goal, then this mutable world loses its meaning the moment you unite with it. So it is explained this way that, well, mutable world provides you some support because you are caught into it. Mutable is the changing world, and through it you take it like you catch hold of a stair and or take a leap, pole vault. So, you take support and go to the other side where there is the immutable Brahman. But there is no reconciliation between the two. But if there is something beyond the immutable, that which holds the mutable and the immutable together within itself, then there is a chance of reconciling. And that's where the Purushottama comes in. And that's where works and bhakti bring a new significance. In fact, bhakti, then only bhakti has a meaning. That's why we'll see Gyan Yogi is decrying bhakti, because they don't fully understand that there is no being, there is no really. So what is there to have bhakti? You concentrate, meditate, and you'll find. So this is how the difference. So Sri Aurobindo takes up this significant question, Nirvana and works in the world, where he primarily goes to end of chapter 5 and chapter 6. And why this question is raised? Because of the certain verses in the Gita which people tend to interpret in a way which is that, well, works are only for ultimately finding the immutable Brahman. And Sri Aurobindo reminds us that if this were so, then repeatedly the Gita would not say, use the word Purushottama, but most importantly, when Arjun asked that why would one work at all? Why work? If jnana is important, why work? So Shri Krishna says that why even a liberated person is engaged in works. And he uses the word sarva bhuta hite rata. The one divine dwells in all. So he clarifies that individual nirvana cannot by its very nature be the last goal. Because that means you are discarding the divine presence in the rest of creation in all other creatures. So a liberated person is engaged in the good of all. And what is this good of all? Is not just distributing blankets, free medicines, hospital. But the good of all is the supreme good, which is awakening to this great truth, great reality, and impelling mankind toward this great consummation, God's march in humanity. So this is the basis that he's engaged in action. So even after he has conquered everything, he doesn't need anything for himself, yet he engages in action. Then in the sixth chapter, we also see a special practice of meditation. Everybody wants to read about meditation. So the Gita does describe one method of more correctly contemplation. It's not really meditation in the strict sense of the word. So the Gita describes that the yogin has to sit in on a place which is not too thick, not too thin, should not be a dunlop, nor should be a floor. This kind of a stuff is fine. This kind of a gentle cushion. He has to practice moderation. So this is another point that, you know, it's not talking about the extinction in nirvana. He has to practice moderation. He has to practice moderation in food. He has to practice moderation in sleep. So a yogi cannot live an extreme life. I mean, truly, he doesn't live an extreme life. He practices moderation, and even these activities, which includes moderation in recreation. Yukta ahar viharasya. So vihara is when you go. So it's not denying life. So number one is that. So he says that Shri Krishna continues to say. And he also says that even after he has realized the Brahma, he is ever engaged in doing the good of all creatures. So essentially the point is that even after one has achieved nirvana, one not only can but should continue doing works in the world. Because God is in the world and he is pouring all his energies in the world. This is the basic logic. But at the same time, the Gita does insist, and that's where people have this confusing idea. Same with Sri Aurobindo's all life is yoga. He said, no, everything is yoga, so I'll continue living life the way I am doing. It doesn't become automatically yoga. So that's why the Gita gives the first step is from the mutable to the immutable. That's where the confusion comes. Detachment. You can't continue to remain asakta. You can't continue to lead a life of desires and ignorance and say that, well, I am doing yoga because Sri Aurobindo has said all life is yoga. Well, we continue to live, but we continue to adopt certain attitudes and practices so that we are no more engaged in the life the way we are ignorantly engaged. By ignorant attachment and engagement means I am the center, I am the doer, I am the receiver, I am the giver, I-centered. So the change has to become God-centered. God is the giver, God is the receiver, God is in all. So this shift has to take place. So this cannot be if I am deeply attached to life and all the people and activities. Obviously it will bring inequality. So equality has to be practiced. Not as a final withdrawal from life, but as a means to arrive at the immutable reality behind all this. But then I have to engage in the world, no more with the egocentric standpoint, but with the divine centric attitude. This is the gist of the whole thing. So we'll just read some passages. So he says on page 234, the union of the soul with the Purushottama by a yoga of the whole being is the complete teaching of the Gita. So yoga is actually any lesser term that yoga for fitness, yoga for feel good, yoga for peace, all actually nonsense. It earns you money, but it doesn't make sense. Yoga doesn't mean that. It may be, Shubhinder has been very generous at places, it can be a preparation or a partial yoga. Nothing wrong with fitness, it's all good. But we should not use the word yoga, even asanas. They are asanas. They don't become yoga asanas unless it is directed towards the goal of yoga. That means to make very consciously to make the body fit so that its restlessness and many of these crudities can drop off so that one can engage better in yoga. Otherwise it has no meaning. So first thing is goal is union with the divine. There is nothing short of any other goal. Short of it is not worthy of, as mother says, anything else is not worthy of Sri Aurobindo's help. Then it continues, not only the union with the immutable self, as in the narrower doctrine which follows the exclusive way of knowledge. Immutable self, unchanging self, we can use the word self-realization with a capital S, or we can use the typical traditional word Brahman. So Brahman, which is aloof and away from the world. Though in the one of the Upanishads, Brahman is Chatushpad, he is also in waking consciousness. But generally people take it that you have to withdraw from here into that. So that's a narrower term. That is why the Gita subsequently, after it has effected this the reconciliation of knowledge and works, is able to develop the idea of love and devotion unified with both works and knowledge as the highest height of the way to the supreme secret. So, because this is the Purushottama, there is love and devotion. Because all are masks of the divine, therefore love with all creatures. Otherwise it makes no sense. Why should one? Because love means attachment. But Sri Aurobindo makes very beautiful observation. Synthesis of yoga, yesterday we were reading. What is the difference between love and attachment? He says, attachment is egoism in love. This one sentence clarifies all. Attachment is egoism in love. So this is the first thing he clarifies. So we have very clearly this karma yoga, where works are a means to reach the divine, and also after finding the divine, one continues to work. This is the thing. So what are the signs that one has found the divine? Self-declaration is one part, but the science is this, that he is anasakta. Even uses terms like nirmoha, niradvando. So nirmoha is not that he is not bothered, but that standpoint is shifted. So he is not asakt. There is no delusion that, oh, somebody is dying, so it is the end of the world. No. A doctor continues to do his work. But one is, oh my God, somehow I can save through ventilator, this, that. No, that's not the way a doctor now engages, because he looks beyond the body. But equally, he doesn't say that, well, you know, what is the point of doing anything? Anyways, everybody has to die one day, this body. He doesn't know that. He'll be a horrifying doctor. So it is his nirmoha. Moha here is delusion. His senses are not clouded that, oh, this is the end. He looks beyond it. But he is fully participating in the world play. So nirmoha, nirdvando. He is free from the dualities of pleasure and pain. In the same chapter will come, sitoshna, sukh dukheshu, hani labho, mana apamaneha. These, all these different dualities which the ego standpoint brings in. Why does it bring? Whatever is pleasing to the ego, flattering to the ego, we say is good. Every person who comes and says, oh, this, you are so wonderful, is a good guy. Every person who even flatters, recently, okay, as an aside, not as a personal opinion, but somebody asked a question, I thought divine will intervene and see, Trump has been elected. So where is the divine intervention? I said, how do you know if this is not the divine intervention? How do you know God's play? Why are you assuming anything at all that because things should be the way I think? I'm not saying this is good or bad. I'm just saying because things don't happen the way I imagine, therefore I start doubting the divine. So God should consult us every time, asking, sir, what do you devotees say? Should I get Trump or should I get? And then he should tick mark. This is such a foolish idea. I mean to say, if at all there is a wisdom in the divine, and if that wisdom exceeds us, then we have to learn to see how he plays. In fact, it's not about who becomes the president. Perhaps we give too much importance to these things. God uses all these as instruments for his own way, his own work. And if we have that state of equanimity, then we understand the God's wisdom that is operating. So we have to be very careful. So the soul is always at peace. It is always in a state of felicity. It doesn't get disturbed. It's nirdvando, nirahankaro, nirmoha, nirbhayo. And then on page 236, we have this line. When the soul is no longer attached to the touches of outward things. So this is the Brahma Nirvana of the Gita. So repeatedly Gita uses the word Brahma Nirvana to qualify it as different from what you have in the Buddhist Nirvana. Fundamentally the experience is same, but in Buddhist it's the Sushunyam. But here it is Brahman. So why it is saying? Because Brahman, ultimately if you see, Brahman extends from this world right to the highest. So, but when you say Shunyam, nothingness, a void, then if I may say so, the individual, if at all we can use the word individual, is stuck in the void. I mean, he is there and dissolves. There is no sense of I anymore, which is correct. But Brahman Nirvana qualifies it further. So here the individual is there, but he is a true individual. He is no more touched by the outward touches of things. So he doesn't react to the touches of outward things. It begins, then one finds the happiness that exists in the self. If it is only Nirvana, then you have to be like, there is no you to even experience anything. So here he is happy inside. Such a one enjoys an imperishable happiness because his self is in yoga, yukta, by yoga with the Brahman. So this is important because he gets free from wrath, passion, desires, all these things he is freed from. So this is Brahma Nirvana. So page 236, same few lines below, toward the end of this passage. Here, very clearly, Nirvana means the extinction of the ego in the higher spiritual inner self. That which is forever timeless, spaceless, not bound by the chain of cause and effect and the changes of the world mutation, self-blissful, self-illumined and forever at peace. So one is one with that state. The yogin ceases to be the ego, the little person limited by the mind and the body. He becomes the Brahman. So he is living in that consciousness of Brahman. There is no extinction in nothingness. See, Brahman is a positive integer of Shunyam, which is a negative integer. Is there two ways of looking at it? So when we use the word Shunyam, basically it's like a negative integer. You're like black hole has light in it, but use the word black hole because nothing escapes. So you can look at it like that. It's a completely something in which there is nothing. But will it be correct? No. The right thing is that there is in it such a concentration of light, and it cannot escape even from that. So there are two ways of looking at the same thing. So Shobindo insists the yogin ceases to be the ego, the little self. By ego is meant a temporary personality constructed by nature in one lifetime with which we identify. That personality consists of the body, the desired self, the sense of me, whose seat is in the mind. So this is a temporary personality which we call as ourselves. So that is extinguished. But does it mean all is extinguished? No. The yogin is now one with the Brahman. So Brahman is acting through the yogin. And therefore he is in bliss. So few lines below. But is this a going? Next passage in fact. But is this a going into some deep sleep of samadhi away from all world consciousness? Because this is a natural thing. Okay, he is absorbed. So then why not be absorbed more and more and finish the matter? That's how the extreme yogas say. Or is it the preparatory movement for a dissolution of the natural being and the individual soul into some absolute self who is utterly and forever beyond nature and her works, lie moksha? It says, is it one of these things or something else? This is what he is going to reveal to us. Is that withdrawal necessary before we can enter into Nirvana? Or is Nirvana, as the context seems to suggest, a state which can exist simultaneously with world consciousness and even in its own way included? So this is what the question is. That if otherwise we'll do flip-flop. When we are withdrawn in samadhi, then world vanishes. And you are happy in that state of inner bliss and peace. And when you come back into the world, then you are no more there, because that has nothing to do with this. So this is a problem. But Shobhinda says, can these two coexist? And Shobhinda speaks of that. In his own experience, he says that the two always went together. In fact, he says, from the time I set my feet upon the soil of India, Apollo Bandar, the worldly and the otherworldly always went together. It was never like withdrawing, having an otherworldly experience, then coming here, which has no connect with that. So always they exist together. Apparently the latter, for in the succeeding verse, the Gita goes on to say, sages win nirvana in the Brahman, they in whom the stains of sin are effaced and the knot of doubt is cut asunder, masters of their selves, who are occupied in doing good to all creatures, sarvabhut hite rata. So he is saying that very clearly, they are sages, they are conscious of the self, not of the lower self. Lower self, so called lower self, is now no more identified, they are not identified, it becomes an instrument, that's all. Like Arjuna has been skilled as an archer, he is excellent. So Krishna uses him as an instrument. Now Arjuna, the ego self, thinks that he is the archer and he has to act according to his own mental ideas, whether he should do or not do. But when Arjuna is merged in the divine self, it doesn't mean he'll abandon archer. He says, no, now I am a different person. Now the archer in Arjuna is simply the instrument of this greater divine person. And he is at his mercy, at his beckon, at his command, that he shoots the arrow. This is the difference. So outwardly one cannot know the signs. The change is happening inside. Few lines below. Freedom from all stain of the passions. So what are the signs of these sages? All stains of the passions. So they don't rush and leap at every event. They don't start discussing animatedly why this problem is there and how we can find a solution to it. The self-mastery of the equal mind. So here self-mastery, naturally, nirdvando, nirahankaro, and all the touches of outward nature. That freedom is founded. Equality to all beings, sarvabhuteshu, and beneficial love for all. So such a person feels that love for all. Even if he is engaged in an action like the war, he must eliminate certain things from creation because that's become now dangerous. But there is no hatred. There is no sense of like, I don't like this person. He does not conform to my way of thinking or my idea about life. Therefore, I will eliminate. No, that will not come at all. He loves all creatures. And beneficial love for all. Final destruction of that doubt and obscurity of the ignorance which keeps us divided from the all-unifying divine. So the final sign that one is in the oneself is that there is no more any doubt. This very beautifully described in one of the Upanishads, I think it is Chandogya, where when do doubts vanish? So I often use this as a criteria that one has found the psychic being. So often there are several markers, of course. But one of them is, and Mother puts it very interestingly, Mother says, when you find it, you will have no more doubt about it. But the Upanishad puts it this way. Bhidyanti hridgranti chidyanti sarvasanshaya. If your heart strings are cut asunder, then obviously when you discover this self within the heart, then all doubts vanish. They vanish actually, they just can't come, whatever happens. Either you will know the play of God or you may not understand, but doesn't matter. Doubt doesn't come that why is God doing this? Why is the divine doing it? It vanishes. So heartstrings, what are these heartstrings? They are these strings of attachment. Because we are attached, we cannot understand God's play. That's why people often ask that, you know, about war and all. If there is a war, divine will use even that for the supramental manifestation. Why are we so much worried about it? We keep on, you know, if suddenly if there is a war going on in this side, that side, where is the supramental manifestation? Somebody asked Aurobindo that I suppose that once the supermind comes, there would be no more wars. He says, on the contrary, it is quite likely that through the wars, the manifestation will take place. They will participate, help in the manifestation. They will shift things. Because unfortunately, because human beings on their own don't shift. Ideally, it should not be. But well, it may be become a necessary because people don't shift from within. So all these things, Sri Aurobindo goes on to reveal to us. And then the next line on the next passage, page 237. Thus, Nirvana is clearly compatible with world consciousness and with action in the world. For the sages who possess it are conscious of and in intimate relation by works with the divine in the mutable universe. How are they in intimate relation? They are occupied with the good of all creatures. Sarvabhuthite ratha. Otherwise they will not be occupied anymore. It's all an illusion. So, they have not renounced the experiences of the Shar Purusha. They have divinized them. For the Shar, the Gita tells us, is all existences, Sarvabhutani. That means, they have not abandoned this world. They have divinized means they start seeing the divine in every creature. So that way they divinize the experience that they are acting not for personal ego's sake, not for the fruits, not for desire, not for what they will come, get personally out of it, but for the joy of working for the divine as a flow of the divine consciousness for doing good in the world. So what happens to their life? How do they sustain it? That's where Sri Aurobindo gives the meaning of the word yoga kshema vahamayam. Because they are in union with the divine and they are engaged in work, no more for personal fulfillment, for any desire fulfillment. So people ask this question, how about them? Now, when they are in union with the divine, it's God's responsibility to look after you. Makes it very easy. But it's not like, oh, that means all my wishes he will fulfill. No. But he'll take care of you. So he, yogic shame, he says, I'll take care of you. So whatever fruits we have to get, that will come to us, but now they will not come from this person. Means people will be instrumental. But they will come. The divine will arrange. And that's where the whole secret of the doctrine lies. Okay. So then, this what he develops. And then he tells us about page 240 we'll come to, where he comes to the sixth chapter and its substance. Page 240, we shall therefore run as briefly as possible through the substance of this sixth chapter. First, the teacher emphasizes, and this is very significant, his often repeated assertion about the real essence of sannyasa, that it is an inward, not an outward renunciation. So that part is very clear. Inner renunciation of the fruits and inner renunciation of egoism of the doer. Inner renunciation of fruits comes, leads us to the renunciation of the desired self. Why do we act under desire? Because we'll get something. Now when we are not, that's how other day we were sharing. If you are not seeking happiness in the world, you are also free from grief. They are like dual, they follow. But if you are seeking happiness, overtly or covertly, you will be touched by grief the moment it is denied to you. So that's where the whole rub lies, that he is not working for the desired self. That's how when we don't work for the fruits that we will get, then automatically the desired self becomes weakened. And when the desired self goes away, then there is perfect peace and happiness. So someone was asking, what is the sign that one has surrendered to the mother? Because this is a euphemism. No, we often use the word surrender to the mother, surrender to the mother. So what is the sign? You will always be in a state of peace and joy. If that is not there, then forget about, you know, all this is talk. If you are surrendered, you will be in peace and happiness. So that is the sign that one has really surrendered to the mother. So that state is acquired by renouncing the desired self, because desire is the one which gives us pleasure and pain. So we buy one pleasure and we get 5 pain free of cost. If we are very fortunate, 10 pains free of cost. If we are very unfortunate, then we get 1 pain maybe after a long time, because we are in evolution slow. Slow motion and evolution fast forward it gives. And renouncing the ego self gives us equality. So, man, apman, praise of people, insult of people leaves no, that's why no stain of sin. It's very interesting. What is the root of sin is egoism. Because I am the doer, therefore I carry the burden of my fate. If I am the doer, then obviously if I kill people, it's not good. I have killed people. So for what? For the kingdom. So there is stain. But if I am not the doer, and is the divine under whose command I do, now I am a fool people, but the divine knows that why he is doing what he is doing. Because he is no more the doer. He is doing my bidding. Then you don't carry the stain of sin. That's how the logic works. And that's why there is the karma bandhan, karma chakra, and the freedom from karma. So karma bandhan is when I am the doer. Okay, fine, I'll teach you. So consequences is that ego is learning, stumbling, grumbling. It's learning. The day the ego self says, I am not the doer, you take the reins of my life, as Arjun says, then the moment you are not the doer, then finished. No karma bandhan. That's the logic. See, it's so simple. People make such a no, your karmas, there will be no karma because there is no karma individually. That's why the mother said the supramental being will have no karma. Why he'll have no karma? Because he doesn't have ego. Ego and supramental being cannot go together. So if there is no ego of the doer, there is no karma. And that is one of the questions that in Savitri, the Supreme asks Savitri herself. He says, you are going to make human beings free of all karmas. He uses the word, if men were gods and no more like men. So he'll finish the link. So karma serves as a double mechanism. One link is the link of love, which binds everything. This is the deeper link, the truer link. That's what the sage realizes. So he is sarvabhuti terata. But love is a profound power. So the other link is karma. Karma operates through desires, attachment, fruits. But because of that, again, the universe is bound in a chain. Now, if a human being is free of karma, now imagine what's happening. There is like an invisible force which is operating in the world, and none of this chain, he is acting upon the chain, but is not responsible outwardly, inwardly for it. So what a tremendous difference it's going to make. So the supramental creation has many ifs and buts, and that's why the mother says you cannot be into the supermind as long as you have ego. The two just don't go together. That's why the yoga of the Gita is a wonderful preparation for entering into the supramental yoga. So, whoever does the work to be done without resort to its fruits, he is the sannyasin and the yogin. As simple as that. If fruits come, you take, not that he is attached to not taking the fruit. So it's not about that. Inwardly you are free. If you receive, you receive as prasad. If you don't receive, it's perfectly fine. That's not what is impelling your actions. So the definition of sannyasin. Not the man who lights not the sacrificial fire and does not the works. What they have called renunciation, sannyas, know to be in truth yoga. For none becomes an yogin who has not renounced the desire will in the mind. So sannyas is sarvasankalpa sannyasi. You are not impelled by the desire. You can't act under desire. You can't act, for example, to please the king. It's one of the famous things, no, about these court poets. So they have to please the king. No, that's one of the dangers. So always, whenever people say, I say, the worst thing is crown of thorns, that you are near to the seats of power. All my life I have said this is the most dangerous. It's a punishment. Because now, you have become vulnerable. If you say yes, you are selling your soul for a pot of porridge, very frankly. If you say no, you are knowingly, unknowingly preparing the guillotine. figuratively. So better to stay away. I really believe that somebody, either God thinks he is like capable. If you become the king, it's okay. Because then you are not. To be near the king in his service is the worst. Because then you have to listen to the king. And if you afford to, if you say that no, you are wrong, then you are in trouble. And if you say yes, you have lost it. So both ways. So this is the state. He is not doing for any fruits. He is doing it as an offering to the divine. But for those who are caught in such a situation, so what is the way? Just do your bit. Do it as an offering to the divine. Don't get into praise. Hail, praise the, you know, so and so. Try to please. Don't do all that. Stay quiet and do the works. It's the story of this man who was once sheikh. He was traveling with a court philosopher. And he saw a man sitting below a tree and eating some porridge. And he said, what is this man doing? He's a crazy fellow. You see, in this summer heat desert, he's sitting below a palm tree and eating something. You think he's a man of worth? He said, but he's, I'm amazed. Who could this person be? So he goes all the way and asks him, who are you? So the court philosopher again says, sir, he's no man of consequence. And then he rebuts this fellow who is eating the porridge quietly. He says, if only you knew how to please the king, you will not have to eat porridge the rest of your life. You are such an impractical fellow. And the man retorts back, if only you knew how to eat porridge, you would not have to please the king for the rest of your life. So you see, now it's a change of outlook. It's not like you are looking for porridge. But life can be so simple. So he is renouncing the fruits of desire. It's such a wonderful remedy for so many ills. So he is the sannyasin. Works are to be done, but with what purpose and in what order? They are first to be done while ascending the hill of yoga. That's where the nishkam karma and all this comes. For then works are the cause, karanam. The cause of what? The cause of self-perfection, of liberation. Because then through the works you arrive at, you discover the knots of ego, desire. Otherwise you are sitting in meditation. How do you know? If somebody disturbs you, you'll get very angry. Why have you disturbed me? So whom were you meditating upon? But when you do work, so many people will tell you all kinds of things. So it becomes the cause of liberation and self-perfection. Because you become aware, conscious of all that is within us. There's the difference. A person engaged in karma yoga, when people say things, so he becomes aware of his reactions. And when in ordinary life, you become aware of others' reactions. See that person, he talked like this. He talked like this is his problem. How you reacted is your problem. So this is where the cause of self-perfection, of liberation, of nirvana in the Brahman. For by doing works with a steady practice of the inner renunciation of this perfection, this liberation, this conquest of the desire mind and the ego self and the lower nature are easily accomplished, because we won't even know otherwise. That's why when God loves you very much, He puts somebody with you, either as husband, wife or family or department, who will poke your ego. It's so important. So otherwise you'll never come to know. Everybody will tell you. And Sadhuji's, Sadhu Baba and all these gurus, they're in a very difficult position. No, you won't even know that, you know, people are talking about you. The bhaktas will block all those avenues. But see how Sri Aurobindo, this is the difference. People would write to him and all kinds of things. They're doubting him. Everything. And Sri Aurobindo is patiently replying. That's the beauty, the difference. He didn't screen himself. People often say that he was in a room. Yes, but he never screened himself. People could write to him anything. There was no screen. And Sri Aurobindo would patiently reply, sometimes the same point so many times. That is the sign of being free from all ego and desired self. So initially, but when one has got to the top, so other thing is okay. Initially it is to have liberation and perfection. That's why in the ashram, there is seldom change of department, which is a very good thing. You have to be with the same person. You like it or you don't like it. So whenever people wanted to change the department, mother would say, see, that's not the solution. Because you will have the same problem elsewhere. So now you see, you have no choice. First you will curse the person, but how long? You have to work with the person. Then you start cursing your destiny. How long? Then you finally say, let me find a way. And after some time you grow friends. So you are forced to see the divine in the other person. Yeah, do you have a choice? So this is the... So okay, now you have arrived at the liberation. Then works are no longer the cause. Because you have arrived at the self-mastery. The calm of self-mastery and self-possession gained by works becomes the cause. Again, the cause of what? Now it becomes the cause of work. That's what he's saying. First is works are the cause to arrive. Now you have arrived at it. Now this is the cause of works, that calm of self-mastery. Why such people are required more and more to work for the divine? So he says, cause of what? Of fixity in the self, in the Brahman consciousness, and of the perfect equality in which the divine works of the liberated man are done. For what one does not get, for when one does not get attached to the objects of sense or to works and has renounced all will of desire in the mind, then is he said to have ascended to the top of the yoga. And there are some signs that beautifully he describes. Sitoshna sukha dukheshu tatha mana apmanya. All yogis have spoken this part, you know, they speak out. It's a very nice pad of Guru Nanak, he says. He says it's not easy to find that, you know, top nirvana. He says, astuti ninda dau tyagi or mana apmana. Stuti is praise. Those who are seeking praise from others, those who are, you know, hurt by the criticism of others, so they are not ready to really find the self. And if they claim they have found the self, then claim anybody can claim anything. So kutastha, somebody who is on a different status of consciousness, indifference. But this yoga is after all no easy thing to acquire. Page 241. As Arjun indeed shortly afterwards suggests, for the restless mind is always liable to be pulled down from these heights by the attacks of outward things. So that's why people, you know, advise that, no, withdraw from the world. Because if you are in the world, you will get hammered. So many things will happen. Therefore, it would seem the Gita proceeds to give us, in addition to its general method of knowledge and works, a special process of Rajyogic meditation, also a powerful method of practice, abhyas, a strong way to the complete control of the mind and all its working. So what is the method of the Gita? Quickly we'll see. Of course, the mother has given us many more methods, but this is the Gita in that context. He is to sit apart and alone with all desire and idea of possession banished from his mind. That means he is no more doing it with a specific result of, you know, of a temporal result. So all this is banished, self-controlled in his whole being and consciousness. So he's, that's why the brahmacharya, that during that state you should not be allowing desires of all kinds to come into the mind. And actually, unless you practice inner detachment, it won't happen, it will come up. Because invariably whatever is your everyday activity, that will come up during meditation. He should set in a pure spot his firm seat. His firm seat. So this pure is of course not so much about, but it's good to have one place and keep its sanctity. Don't let all kinds of vibrations and forces. The idea of a personal meditation room or a place where you can sit and meditate in Indian household. Otherwise, one tends to have, one has to take time first to clear that atmosphere. Neither too high, nor yet too low. Covered with a cloth, with a deer skin, of course, please don't do it now. Animal activities, and quite rightly, I mean, well, deer skin was the dead deer skin, okay, to qualify. It was not like people are killing a deer and using them, because sometimes people ask. Somebody asked me in Shurabindo's room, you know, there is the tiger skin. I said, Baba, tiger has died or a panther has died, huh? That skin is used. It's used. Somebody has bought and given it to him. So he has received it. It's not like you kill and then take the skin. We have this conception, no? We jump to conclusions. There is a natural death. And when they, or unnatural death, whatever it be, when you have died, that skin is used. It's something very, in certain sense, it makes sense, especially when people are outdoor. You see, that is skin nature has created to safeguard you against many, you know, touches of outer nature. So, because animals have that natural protection. And in Ramayana, the monkeys, the apes, so-called apes, Vanara, they were Vanvasis who were using this as a means. So they had this whole thing with a tail and also to confuse the other animal. Even Jamvant, he is using the deer skin. It's not like there is an actual Bhalu who is talking in English or Hindi or whatever, Sanskrit. They're quite cultured people, simple folks who use this as a means of, which is perfectly fine, which is very different from killing. And it was a very good way of clearing the environment. Okay, enough of this. So, deer skin. No, people raise this question. Deer skin, why? And there are some finicky people, they will only use a deer skin. Okay. With sacred grass. Sacred grass, why? You know, which is sacred grass? This is Durva. So if you look at this grass, Durva, it is very soft. So if you put, really, it makes a very good, why otherwise you will be pricked by all kinds of things. But it is considered sacred. There is a whole story about the Durva grass. So it's good because there is a symbol behind it, very nice. So sacred grass. Okay. Why this is important? Because otherwise if you don't have a sacred grass, I won't meditate. No, that's not what he is saying. So, essence you have to understand. And they are seated with a concentrated mind and with the workings of the mental consciousness and the senses under control, he should practice yoga for self-purification, Atma Vishuddhi. So, that's what is important. So that the mind is freed from all this, at least for some time, give it a bath, wash. Mother has made it very simple. She says, when people come to me, I give them the bath of the Lord. She has, Divine Mother, no, she has made it simple for us. But we are still in the age of the Gita. The posture he takes must be the motionless, erect posture proper to the practice of Raja Yoga. The vision should be drawn in and fixed between the eyebrows, not regarding the regions. So this is obviously because it's much easier to concentrate here than in the heart. Some people, of course, find it easier here, but generally, that's how it is. So, last line below is, thus, always putting himself in yoga by control of his mind, the yogin attains to the supreme peace of nirvana, which has its foundation in me. Now comes this catch. Nirvana is not the goal. Nirvana itself is within the divine, the Purushottama. So in that still self, one sees state, one sees the step, self. So page 242. The main stress here has fallen on the stilling of the emotive mind, the mind of desire and the senses, which are the recipients of outward touches and reply to them with our customary emotional reactions. But even the mental thought has to be stilled in the silence of the self-existent being. So this what one has to be practiced. Otherwise, people come out of their meditation often much worse, because in the meditation also it's going on. He said this to me. I said, I should have said this. I didn't say. So all that emotive mind is active. Then one may sit in meditation, but it makes no sense. Page 243. When the mind is thoroughly quieted, then there comes upon the yogin the highest, stainless, passionless bliss of the soul that has become the Brahman. Then, in the next passage, he is saying, this yoga, it says, is not for the man who gives up sleep and food and play and action, even as it is not for those who indulge too much in these things of the life and the body. So, this we have already spoken about, that you should be in a state of moderation is to be practiced in life in general. And these special practices are as a kind of, because few human beings can all the time be engaged in karma yoga, as has been expounded. So a special practice is given. Twice a day, 20 minutes or 30 minutes, one can sit in meditation like that. So what ultimately is the sign? That comes on page 244. There was a question about what happens. Arjun raises this question, that is very difficult to practice all this. So what happens if one dies unfinished? He says in the next life, he is born in the family who sincerely tried to practice the yoga but could not. So he goes to a place which is like a heaven of virtues. So then he returns back. He is born in a family of devotees, where he quickly picks up the yoga. So he is born, it's Sri Krishna's responsibility. That's what he says. He says, I'll take care of that. where you will fall. Don't worry about it. With the Divine Mother even much more. So one automatically goes to that family where, that's why all this, you know, one should not want where I will go. Well, wherever she wants me to go, she knows best. So one is born in a family where one quickly picks up the yoga. That's why sometimes I do feel it may sound partial, but being born in India is a privilege. And this is what is talked about in the scriptures also. So they say that being born in India is like India is a yoga bhumi. Whereas rest of the world is like a bhog bhumi. So you go there to enjoy life. And that's true. There's so much to enjoy, the pleasure and desired self. But birth in India, actually, if you see, many of us, I'm sure, who have been born and brought up here, many things we just pick up from mother's milk, actually. So whether we put it to good use or not, it's like you may inherit big riches but throw it away. That's the other side of the unfortunate thing. Sometimes when you are outside, you seek much more and you are... But otherwise, you are born in a family of devotees, of people who are practicing yoga. So it becomes very quick. You pick up quickly. So what is the sign of such a person? Is there no danger when he acts in the world? So Sri Krishna answers that will he not lose the divine when he is entering into the world? So Sri Krishna says, no, says the Gita, page 244. He who sees me everywhere and sees all in me, to him I do not get lost, nor does he get lost to me. So it's very simple. Wherever you are, try to see the divine. Try. It may not happen easily, but that's where the concentration should be, that divine dwells in all. So the next question is 244, towards the last paragraph. But why act? Oh, here he has given this yogkshem here also, very beautifully. Page 244, this word, because this word is often used. So in the first passage itself, 4 or 5 lines from above, he says, luminous knowledge higher than the mental thought comes out of that. A power other and mightier than the personal will comes out of that to do for him his works and bring its fruits. So when a yogin is free of all personal sense of doership, then a greater power takes hold and it does the work for him with obviously far greater results and brings the fruits automatically. So then, but why act? Is it not safer to sit in one solitude, looking out upon the world, if you will, seeing it in Brahman, in the divine, but not taking part in it, not moving in it, not living in it, not acting in it, living rather ordinarily in the inner samadhi? Page 245. No, again, for the liberated yogin, there is no other law, rule, dharma than simply this, to live in the divine and love the divine and be one with all beings. His freedom is an absolute and not a contingent freedom, because if you have to sit in isolation, then you are not really free. It's conditional. In Savitri, there is a very powerful line where he says, what kind of freedom is this, that I have to be free from outer bonds to be free? He says, I can be in the chain of love and yet free. What a powerful, you never look at it like that. That's truly unconditional freedom. It doesn't depend on any outer condition. That story of Sri Aurobindo, no, where he is smoking the cigar, and one was that Gandhi's, I think, son came and he asked him, sir, why are you attached to smoking? And Sri Aurobindo said, but why are you attached to non-smoking? But see the other side. Mother just once went and told him, you know, the boys don't understand. Basically meaning, they are taking your example. So they are also doing their own smoke. That, well, Lord smokes, you can smoke and go to highest. So Sri Aurobindo said, oh, and dropped completely. Never once felt any urge. It dropped. My own feeling is he was working upon, now today you see cigarette is dangerous, all this. But whatever be the reason. So there is neither ways, you know, things. And there are so many interesting stories out of it, which includes somebody whom mother was giving money to smoke cigarette. Dara. So, you know, we can't bracket and bind the divine into any format. So the yogin is free. So this liberated man lives in the divine and love the divine and be one with all beings. His freedom is an absolute and not a contingent freedom. Self-existent and not dependent any longer on any rule of conduct, law of life or limitation of any kind. He has no longer any need of a process of yoga. Liberated man is now liberated. Whether he sits in meditation, he goes to or doesn't go, all this becomes... He may still do it, he may not do it. So he is liberated. But the reason will be very different. The yogin who has taken his stand upon oneness and loves me in all beings, however and in all ways he lives and acts in me. The love of the world spiritualized changed from a sense experience to a soul experience. What a line this is. Love of the world spiritualized changed from a sense experience to a soul experience. Seeing the divine in everything and everywhere. Not human beings, this, that. So instead of that. Is founded on the love of God, and in that love there is no peril and no shortcoming. Fear and disgust of the world may often be necessary for the recoil from the lower nature, for it is really the fear and disgust of our own ego which reflects itself in the world. But to see God in the world is to fear nothing. It is to embrace all in the being of God. To see all is the divine, as the divine is to hate and loathe nothing, but love God in the world and the world in God. Now what he is going to say is literally mind-blowing, heart-blowing, everything. Because now he raises this question. But at least the things of the lower nature will be shunned and feared. The things which the yogin has taken so much trouble to surmount. And a greed for Rasgulla. He has with great difficulty got over Rasgulla. So he must not go wherever there is Rasgulla. That's what somebody told Sri Ramakrishna. Narendra, he goes, sits, and you are saying so highly about him. He says, even if he goes outside, travels far, sits with pretty women, with a glass of wine, and is eating meat, he will purify. He will remain nityamukt. So that is the... So he says, will he not shun those things? Not this either. All is embraced in the equality of the self-vision. It's very powerful. It requires tremendous courage even to, you know, absorb this. Or the experience. He, O Arjun, who sees with equality everything in the image of the self, whether it be grief or it be happiness, him I hold to be the supreme yogin. So that's the state. So what is the work? His job description. What is his job description? Page 245, last five lines. Moved only by them to help and heal, to occupy himself with the good of all beings. This is job description. To lead men to the spiritual bliss, to work for the progress of the world, Godwards. He shall live the divine life so long as days upon earth are his portion. See, divine life Shivendra is describing. The God lover who can do this, can thus embrace all things in God, can look calmly on the lower nature and the works of the Maya of the three gunas and act in them and upon them without perturbation or fall or disturbance from the height and power of the spiritual oneness. Free in the largeness of the God vision. You see, it happens. So sometimes, like I see people think, coming from the ashram, if they pick up a plate which has meat, I said, you eat meat, it's your problem. It's like, what's the big deal? They want to discuss, but they have meat or sometime a glass of wine, Barcelona, at the end of the day. So after that, they want to celebrate. So obviously, they have their own way of looking at life. So they got a wine and a toast. So is it okay? Shall we pour for you? I said, you won't be sin, nor will I be. It's okay, you can pour. Whether I take or not is my choice, and I'll tell you how much. So just a little, just to not to, you know, cheers. Very, just a sip. I said, it's okay. It's not like it's a sin you are committing, or It's an approach, a habit people have developed. So start judging them based on this little glass that somebody has picked up in the hand. So all these notions you are completely freed from. Because you are sitting on the table at a banquet with the divine. You are not sitting with people. And then this wine becomes a wine divine. This is of course a way of saying. So you don't take, but you are not shrinking, repulsion, all that is not there, that goes away. Free in the largeness of the God vision, largeness, sweet and great and luminous in the strength of the God nature, may well be declared to be the supreme yogin, jitaha sargaha. That is the sign of yogin. Not this dress or the Gita brings in here as always bhakti as the climax of the yoga. Sarva bhuta sthitam yo mam bhajati ekatvam asita. That may almost be said to sum up the whole final result of the Gita's teaching. Whoever loves God in all and his soul is founded upon the divine oneness, however he lives and acts in God. And naturally such a person cannot speak about or ever want individual moksha, because then you have never really loved God in all. The yogin is greater than the doers of ascesis, than the tapasvi. Doers of ascesis are tapasvi. Greater than the men of knowledge, who have the jnana. Greater than the men of works, become then the yogin, O Arjuna. Here men of works means who by use karma yoga to realize the divine. But this is a yogin who is united with the divine and yet working in the world, though free. And now comes the master line, the punch line. But even among yogins, the greatest is the bhakta. He loves God in all. Of all yogins, he who with all his inner self given up to me, for me, has love and faith, shraddhavan bhajate, him I hold to be the most united with me in yoga. It is this that is the closing word of these first six chapters and contains in itself the seed of the rest of that which still remains unspoken and is nowhere entirely spoken, for it is always and remains something of a mystery and a secret, rahasyam, the highest spiritual mystery and the divine secret. So we'll close here. Jai Ma.